Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, who are now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Jody Cowan. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with learning the importance of community radio stations from one of the founders of Prometheus Radio, creating stations around the U.S. and the world. Then, Christine Copper of the 518 Direct Support Professionals Alliance explains the crisis in staff support for people with disabilities. Later on, as part of Election Watch 2021, we hear from Justin Foster, a candidate from Rensselaer County Clerk in this November's election. After that, Tia Dubusin, the co-founder of Bell Floor Technologies, discusses the role of women in science, technology, engineering, and math, or STEM fields. Finally, Hugh Johnson, retired meteorologist, joins us for an on-air interview to continue his reports on the causes and effects of climate change. But first, here are some headlines.
The Times Union reports that more Black Lives Matter protesters plan to turn themselves in to Saratoga City Police this week, bringing the total number of arrests stemming from a July rally to 10. The New York Civil Liberties Union stated that the Saratoga Police Department, quote, is on an authoritarian crusade to silence its critics, even going as far as to target people accused of low-level misdemeanors for arrests at their jobs, a chilling development, end quote.
A resolution attacking local activist and Schenectady School Board member Jamaica Miles for calling to defund the police that had been tabled by the Public Safety Committee was the subject of much public comment at this week's Schenectady City Council meeting. The Gazette reports that Miles stated, there is a troubling trend developing here in the Capital Region, a coordinated backlash from city council members, district attorneys, and other law enforcement against the recent protest about racial inequality, structural violence, and poverty. The head of the NAACP also spoke out against the resolution. Several Republicans, as well as some community members, spoke in favor of more funding for the police.
Governor Kathy Hochul announced Monday that she will shore up loose ends in New York's Reproductive Health Act and affirm abortion access for those who need the services. Senator Gillibrand also said she would introduce federal legislation to codify Roe v. Wade into federal law and guarantee abortion care throughout the country by establishing a safeguard against bans and medically unnecessary restrictions like those currently introduced in Texas.
And some good news, the smoking rate among high school students in New York State has dropped from 27% in 2000 to less than 3% today. And that's it for the headlines.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. If you like what you hear, find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call 518-272-2390.
And now for our first segment. Petri Dish was a member of the founding collective of Radio Mutiny, 91.3 FM in Philadelphia, and a founder of the Prometheus Radio Project. Petri Dish goes around the country helping low-power community radio stations, including our own WOOC, with the engineering needed to get on the air and stay on the air. Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Mark Dunley talked with Petri Dish about his work on community radio and his current efforts in Philadelphia.
For a special segment here on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, we're joined by Petri Dish, who is one of the real, leaders, founders of the community radio movement, active radio mutiny in Philadelphia around 96 or so, and goes around the country helping to put together a community radio station. So, Petri, what brings you to Capital District this time?
Really excited to be here. This is one of my favorite groups of stations to work on, all the ones that are around the Capital Region. And right now we're making some repairs on some of the stations. Some of you might have noticed that some of the signals have been weak lately, but hopefully by the time I go, they all should be running again. And so just doing a little bit of regular maintenance on some of these stations.
So besides apparently going everywhere to help, these local community radio stations do the engineering, get on the air, you're also quite active down in Philadelphia, and I guess there's a coalition or collective of eight community radio stations that you're involved with?
That's right. We have a group that we call SCRAP, which is the Swarming Community Radio All Over Philadelphia. And it's around the Philadelphia region. It includes one in Delaware and one in New Jersey. And all these stations together, what we're doing is my organization and Prometheus Radio Project. We've been trying to do some of the things to support the stations, to help them improve their quality and to make running them easier. And, it's a challenge for all these groups. Most of them never did radio before they got the low-power FM station, and a lot of them built their radio station on bake sale money, without any real major grants or anything. So what we've been trying to do is take some of the things that are really hard for them to learn and try to just take care of them for them. For instance, I do a lot of the engineering, so not everyone that wants to be on the radio should have to learn how to climb radio towers and, fix antennas and all that sort of thing. So that's one thing my group does for them, help them some with the management and also with some audio training. And so that's where it's a little interesting for you in the Mohawk region, because we took our idea for our training from the Hudson Mohawk News. We have a program once a week called Indie Radio Garden. And basically, it's like the greatest hits from all of the stations around the region. Everyone's invited to submit 5-minute segments, 10-minute segments sometimes, of a really great interview that they had on their station, or some good local news, or someone went to a protest, or an author comes to town. So we collect those and edit them together. And it's also a really good opportunity. One of the things we really learned from Hudson Mohawk is the importance of feedback for producers and participating in something larger. Because sometimes in community radio, you have people that just like get on the air and they just talk and they actually never really listen to it again and see how good it sounded. Mm-hmm. So it's an opportunity for your peers to listen and to give you some ideas and say, oh, well, that sounded good. This is something you could have done better next time. And so it's a way of improving and strengthening their programs back at their own stations.
Now, I don't know a lot about Philadelphia. I was there during the Democratic National Convention where Clinton was selected. And then I hang out a bit with Sherry Honkala, who does the Kensington Welfare Rights Union in Philadelphia. But, what are the type of stories that, you are getting? And particularly, here locally, of course, the Black Lives Matter movement has been big, and I imagine that's really big in Philly.
Of course, that was definitely huge in Philadelphia. And we get a lot of different stories from different stations. Some of them, they're each in different parts of the city. So, for instance, we get a lot of stories from Germantown. There's a very strong community radio station in Germantown called G-Town Radio. And with that one, some particularly interesting ones were a bunch of youth went out and did interviews with other youth about different issues. There was also a number of interviews with local business owners and how they were affected by the pandemic. We started the collaboration just about 3 weeks after the pandemic started. And so there were a lot of challenges in terms of like people being able to go out and record audio the way they normally would, and how to do interviews from remotely. So I would say the biggest focus for the first year of it has been, things related to COVID. And of course, Black Lives Matter when that happened in the summer. So those were some of the biggest topics that we covered.
Now, so you've been instrumental in helping to, spur community radio, literally all across the country, and obviously the big problem remains the increase in not only corporatization of the media, but the monopoly practices. You know, how much of an impact do you think the community radio movement, you know, is having here in the country?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, one thing that we always talk about with community radio is certainly there's an impact on listeners, but one of the biggest impact is on the participants and the people that get involved in community radio in terms of being able to learn the skills to produce media, to be able to, you know, to sort of put it out there, to have a platform to that they can work with. And there's also and also having the collaboration and the feedback of working together on making news and public affairs, as well as, you know, supporting local arts and different, you know, music and all that sort of thing. So, in this era, I think it's interesting what's happened with radio. I mean, radio, there's very little attention to it in like the discourse about it, but still 90% of Americans listen to the radio every week. And the numbers, you know, you compare it to some other things like VCRs, like right when like DVDs came in, VCRs went bam, like down into the toilet. Radio is a very, very long, slow, you know, radio's not getting bigger, but it's getting smaller, much, much slower than all the other kinds of media. Done a lot better than TV and newspapers, in fact, in terms of its continued use. So, we see a big impact in that. Now, and we still continue to see conservative talk radio playing a huge role in elections in terms of perpetuating these sort of baseless conspiracy theories that float around in conservative talk radio. So there's still quite a bit of impact that radio has on public dialogue. And there are definitely some things about it that I think are going to continue to appeal to people. For one thing, when you listen to the radio, nobody knows that you're listening to the radio. And nobody takes the information that you're listening to one channel or the other and turns it into like an advertisement to you for socks or mattresses mm-hmm. or whatever. Whereas everything online, I mean, basically like everything you listen to is incredibly invasive in terms of the impact that it has on you. So one thing I still like about listening to radio is that it's anonymous in a way that we're almost forgetting that we can be today.
So we've been talking with Petri Dish, one of the real, visionaries in the community radio movement. We have just about a minute left, Petri. What would you say to people? Why should they support and how should they support community radio?
Well, the biggest thing is to get involved. You have a fantastic opportunity here with the Hudson Mohawk News. Just about anyone can go and get trained to do interviews and do editing. And so anything that's important to you, anything that you want to share with your community, you've got an incredible resource. Well, you know, one of the best in the country right here. So, give a try to, you know, becoming a community reporter.
And that's been Petri Dish. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, of course, mediasanctuary.org.
Thank you, Mark Dunley, for that report. And thank you, Petri Dish, for your work to get us here at WOC a transmission boost. Listeners in Albany can look forward to a stronger signal already as Petri Dish has started work just this week and bring our network dish to taller heights.
And yes, we welcome you to join us as a volunteer producing community radio. For our next segment, Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Steve Pierce speaks with Kristen Copper of the 518 Direct Support Professionals Alliance about the crisis in staff support for people with disabilities.
On the phone, we have Kristen Copper, who is an organizer with the 518 Direct Support Professional Alliance. Welcome, Kristen.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Can you tell us a bit about the 518 Direct Support Professional Alliance?
Sure. So it's a group that brings together people who work in the field with people with IDD and disabilities. A lot of the members are direct support professionals who work within homes or day programs. But we also have some people who just feel passionate about advocating for the rights for people with disabilities in the field in general, and they are very welcome to join as well.
So what is a direct support professional?
It's someone who provides direct care to people with disabilities. So they help them with living skills, you know, they help them cook, they help them make meals, they help them take showers, they help them get dressed in the morning. And then it can also go to other things as well, like helping them in a workplace, learning a job, helping them learn budgeting skills, taking them out into the community to meet with friends and family members. So direct support professionals really carry out a wide variety of tasks on the job. And it's really important work and meaningful work.
Who are the kinds of folks who need that support?
So there's people within the residential homes who, you know, have the direct care workers in the homes helping them with the daily living skills. And then in the day habilitation programs, there's staff there who provide, you know, different learning activities for them to do, help them learn social skills if they need that, help them out and to get out into the community. So it's people who just kind of need that extra support or care. And that's what direct support professionals are there to do, to help with whatever needs they have.
And so why do direct support professionals need the support of an alliance?
So right now the field is facing a really terrible staffing crisis. Statewide, there's a 25% vacancy rate. And a lot of the homes and programs are actually having to close down because of the severe understaffing issues. And a lot of that is stemming from a lack of living wages for DSPs. Around here, the starting wage, I know I personally was making $12.80 an hour. That's a wage, you know, people can't live off of that. They can't pay their bills at home. They can't pay their rent. They can't buy groceries off of that wage. So it's very hard for agency providers to retain or also attract new staff to be direct support professionals. So in my opinion, I really view that the lack of a living wage is causing this terrible staffing crisis to happen. So 518 DSPA or Direct Support Professional Alliance is advocating for an increase in funding so that we can start providing a true living wage to DSPs and to help combat the workforce crisis that's happening. And so that, you know, the people who are in the homes and programs can start having a decent quality of life, because right now the staffing crisis is so bad, it's really impacting them.
What is your definition of a living wage?
I would say, you know, in a perfect world, direct support professionals should be making at least 18 to 20 an hour, if not a little bit more. You know, there's a lot of certifications and training they have to go through. A lot of them have to be med certified. So you're passing medications, you know, you're taking medications into the homes, you're sorting them, you're actually administering them. That's a huge responsibility. And you're caring for somebody every day and making sure, you know, things are going well. So they really deserve a living wage. And I would say, you know, around here in the capital region, 18 to 20 hour at least, so that they can comfortably pay their bills and, you know, live a good lifestyle at home as well.
What's the impact on the people with disabilities when you're looking at a 25% shortfall in staffing? What does their day look like?
So unfortunately, when COVID hit, you know, everyone was staying home. But afterwards, you know, things started opening up in New York, and a lot of us kind of returned to some, I guess you would call some normalcy. But in a lot of these homes and programs that are run by the nonprofit agencies, it hasn't been able to fully return to normalcy. And that's because of the staffing crisis. Statistically, 48% of agencies had to close programs or reduce operations due to the staffing shortages. So that really shows, you know, 48%. A lot of the people used to go to dayhab programs where they could do, you know, their activities, they could get out into the community. Some places haven't been able to do that. Some places haven't been able to reopen day programs because they don't have the staff for it. So there's some people who have been home, you know, unable to return to their previous normalcy because of the staffing issue. And that's not right. That's not a good quality of life for them.
So you're talking about people with disabilities who are just sitting at home alone without support because there's no money to pay for the people to do it.
Basically, yeah. Yep. And, you know, it's hard to get the correct amount of staff into the homes as well when we're dealing with this issue. So a lot of the staff, you know, might be running below the ratios that are recommended. So a house that, you know, previously would run on 3 staff now might be running on 1. So it's harder to get people out of the house to do their preferred activities. And it's just harder all around to provide the proper care to people when you're understaffed. And it kind of, you know, brings into another issue. This understaffing is causing direct support professionals to work a lot of hours, unhealthy amounts of hours. You know, I know DSPs who are working 60, 70, 80 hours a week to cover the openings.
From what little I know about this this area, it seems like a lot of the issues are really about poverty. People with disabilities who can't work are kept at poverty level by definition. They're not allowed to have assets of more than, I don't know, $2,000. If they work at all, that's deducted from their supports, from their Social Security disability. So the whole climate in which care of people with disabilities exists in this country is one of just deprivation, not just of the people who are themselves disabled, but the people who take care of them. What do you think needs to happen for that to change?
I think there needs to be more awareness in our communities about what's happening. There needs to just be more integration of people with disabilities into our communities as well.
It just seems striking that in such a wealthy country that there's so many people with basic human needs who aren't getting served by the system that we have put in place. I guess it's better than other places, but it just seems to be, lacking. What are you all doing to try to change this situation?
We're really, you know, welcoming more people to join and want this to, you know, create a movement where we can bring these issues to light, have outside community members start learning about what's going on and try to push for change, you know, try to push politicians to really advocate for increasing the funding because that's what we need.
So what you're talking about is a need for a political movement that can put pressure on political leaders to make the changes that you have, that you see are necessary.
Yeah. Yep.
And so how can people become a part of that movement?
So you can find 518 Direct Support Professional Alliance on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/518DSPA. We also have an email that you can always feel free to reach out to, 518DSPA@gmail.com. We send out newsletters about what events that are coming up, ways to join in. So we're always open to people reaching out.
What would you like to say that I forgot to ask you? Anything you want to add?
Just that I think, you know, part of the reason we're starting to push for changes now is because direct support professionals worked through all of COVID. We were putting, you know, our own health and safety on the line to provide care to other people. And, you know, we're happy to do that because we truly care about the people we support. But when you're doing that, that just really shows that we need the recognition, the respect, and we deserve to be paid a living wage for the work that we're doing.
Well, Kristen Copper, thank you so much for being with us here on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you so much.
We'll talk to you again soon.
Hey.
And that was Hudson Mohawk Magazine producer and Media Sanctuary executive director Steve Pierce talking with Kristen Cooper of the 518 Direct Support Professionals Alliance. For more information that contact again is www.facebook.com/518DSPA.
For those of you just tuning in, I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Jody Cowan. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the ancestral and unceded homelands of the Mohican people, now known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community. Excuse me.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community, for the community, and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support us with your money and your talents, visit the Sanctuary for Independent Media at mediasanctuary.org.
On November 2nd, Rensselaer County voters will see a new name on the ballot for the position of county clerk. Justin Foster is running to unseat Frank J. Marola, who is serving his third term as Rensselaer County Clerk. HMM correspondent Corinne Carey spoke with Justin about his priorities and the important work of the county clerk.
Justin, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you for having me here. I'm glad to be a part of this.
You are running for the office of Rensselaer County Clerk. What made you decide to run for this position?
I don't think that there's any one true reason that somebody runs for office. Generally, it is something where you see several things happening at once, and you get to the point where you make a decision and say, something needs to change, and I have the skill sets, or I have the qualifications, or I have the knowledge that can really help to improve things. And that's really how I arrived at the decision to run for Rensselaer County Clerk. I see a county that is transitioning from what may be a collection of bedroom communities to a county that has organizations like Regeneron, where it's actively working on developing COVID vaccines and responses to pandemics. And I think we really need to bridge that gap. And I think that the county is not necessarily prepared or has the vision to be able to do that at this point.
What does the county clerk do?
So the county clerk is an interesting role. It's largely apolitical. It's rooted in, you can trace it back to the Magna Carta in 1215, where it was the office of the recorder or the registrar. And essentially, at one point, somebody decided everybody needs something recorded, whether it's a birth, whether it's a death, whether it's a property transaction. And that's really where this office came out of. Now, with that said, in Rensselaer County, the office involves handling interactions for the Department of Motor Vehicles, but it also handles interactions with the courts, with recording wills, with recording property and deed mortgages. You also have services like recording veterans' discharges or somebody who's starting a business and filing their DBA. So it's really one of the most active interaction points and offices for residents in Rensselaer County.
I'm curious about whether there are areas of discretion that a county clerk has and whether that discretion is ever exercised in a way that's motivated by politics.
Well, I think that that could be true for most offices. You know, in the world of public sector employment and in government administration, there is the law and there is policy. And so you are working to follow both the letter of the law as well as the spirit of the law or legislative intent, depending on what the situation may be. I think that the goal of anybody who's serving in the county clerk's role would be to figure out how to get residents and how to get small business owners from point A to point B in the best or the most convenient way possible while fulfilling the letter and the spirit of the law that's put before them.
What's the most important issue that you think will face the county clerk should you be successful in gaining this role?
The most important thing is really the ability to be adaptable, to be flexible, and to focus on our technological and innovative needs in Rensselaer County. It's something where we've gone through all of the other county clerk websites in the state of New York and have found a real disconnect between what could be offered and what is currently being offered. And if we want to be seen as a, not necessarily competitive, but a really great location to build a business or to move or to engage in different types of opportunities, we need to be able to back that up and be able to provide the most accessible way possible for individuals to explore Rensselaer County for those purposes.
Justin, the official functions of local government were upended by the pandemic. What grade would you give the Rensselaer County Clerk's Office on their ability to adapt to the restrictions that came along with the pandemic?
You know, I think that everybody struggled, and I think that it was hard for everybody. I would not necessarily base the grade on anybody who did anything in probably the first month or two, but I'm looking at where we are now, you know, 18 months after closure and how we are reopening. And I find that there's a significant gap between, again, what we could be doing and what we are doing. As far as a grade is concerned, I think that we're really at about a C grade.
I'm interested in hearing what some of your priorities are for the office.
Sure. Well, we've recently released a strategic plan that goes year by year for 4 years with an optional extension for 8 years so that we can really have a clear vision going in and provide to voters exactly what it is that we would like to do. The core areas that in speaking with voters and with residents and with small business owners that we really need to focus on in Rensselaer County is on transparency, on accessibility, on adding value from the county clerk's office, and on partnership. So with that said, we've identified, you know, one of those key components for each year and provided kind of a timeline, the way that we would build on things, where we would start, where we would go through, and tried to be as comprehensive as we possibly could. Accessibility really comes down to, again, technological accessibility, language accessibility, being welcoming, being inviting. Transparency comes from, you know, being able to publish open data and not relying on an email to boil for several months that may go unanswered. When we talk about adding value, it's about connecting small businesses with opportunities both inside and outside of the county, especially when they're disadvantaged businesses. And we're also looking at partnership by forming something along the lines of a scholars program with organizations like Hudson Valley Community College, so that we can encourage the next generation of public sector employees or of government administrators and people that may have new technologies, new skills, different perspectives that are coming to this area and maybe don't plan to stay here very long, but maybe their experience by working and giving back to the community will encourage them to stay and become far more involved in Rensselaer County.
Are any of these efforts, which sound like attempts to modernize the office, already underway in the clerk's office that you're aware of?
Not to the best of my knowledge. I have yet to see any updates that look like as if we're working along these lines. My general response and understanding of what I see going on is that we've made a full speed approach to going back to everything the way that it was. And that's not necessarily going to work for everybody. You know, residents and businesses in Rensselaer County learned how to adapt or they closed. So for government to go back to exactly what it was doing and not expect to provide anything more, I don't think is realistic. It's not sustainable.
You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, and I'm speaking with Justin Foster, who's a candidate for the Rensselaer County Clerk position. This interview is part of a series, Hudson Mohawk Magazine's Election Watch 2021. I didn't see anything in your plan, and I may have missed it, frankly, about data privacy. Is data privacy a concern for you?
Well, data privacy is a concern, and I think it's something along the lines of providing information and education to individuals. I try to advocate for it as best as possible, provide people with the information that's out there, and then everybody has to make their own choice. Everyone's going to have their own comfort level. What really concerned me going into this election and seeing what was happening and hoping that this is not something that extends beyond this is when we first had the ability to register for vaccination in Rensselaer County. And the first attempt that really was something that held up was sending an email with sensitive information to a Gmail account that was not necessarily foilable, that was not necessarily protected, and certainly wasn't within the ownership of the county. And that for me set off a series of red flags. So anything that I would do as the county clerk, data privacy, as far as that would be concerned, would be something that I would want to really give weight to and be able to provide people with the knowledge and the assurance that the information that we're holding for them is going to be something that's kept safe.
I know that you just welcomed a new member to your family. So congratulations on that. And so the question that I want to ask you is what you do when you're not out on the campaign trail, what you do to relax, what you do for fun. But I suspect I know the answer at this point.
As of right now, what we do are many, many trips to NICU. And I have to say that the staff at Albany Medical Center and their NICU have been absolutely amazing and have been very helpful and supportive. We had an early delivery and everything about it was very, very sudden. But we try to be as adaptable and as flexible as possible in every facet of our life. So right now, most of my free time is consumed with making sure that the nursery that might not have been completely ready is ready very, very soon.
Well, congratulations again on welcoming that newest member of your campaign team.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Justin, for speaking with me.
I appreciate the time, and I look forward to meeting voters and speaking with more individuals in Rensselaer County throughout the coming months.
And we just heard from Justin Foster, who is running for Rensselaer County Clerk, speaking with Hudson Mohawk Magazine correspondent Corinne Carey. This interview is part of our program's Election Watch 2021 series, featuring profiles of those seeking an office in November's general election. Earlier interviews can be found at mediasanctuary.org.
In this next segment, Gabby Hall interviews Tia Dubison, CEO and co-founder of Bell Floor Technologies. This is the first part of an interview done by Gabby Hall for her podcast series, Notorious SHE.
I'm Gabby Hall, and today I will be interviewing Tia Dubison as part of my series on women in STEM. Tia, thank you for joining me.
For having me here, it's really great to reconnect with you. My name is Tia Dubison. As you have mentioned, I am the co-founder and president of Bell Floor Technologies. And we are a consulting firm that is focused in data and analytics solutions and delivering those to our customers and helping them to basically get the most out of the data insights. Like having data is not enough, but actually having actionable, you know, items out of that data or recommendations, that's what everybody wants, right? So taking the data lake and the data story beyond a buzzword and really making it something that's tangible, actionable, and usable.
Awesome. That's so great. Could you tell us a little bit about your journey of getting into STEM?
Absolutely. So my journey, I guess, into STEM, actually, if we go way back, I always thought I would be a lawyer. And I remember my summer before going to college, I actually went to intern for a corporate lawyer and I hated it. I thought there's no way, and nothing against corporate lawyers. We love lawyers. We have lawyers. I'm so glad that that's, you know, it's, I think it's important to know what you want to do as much as you don't, you know what you don't want to do. And I think that summer I found out, okay, I have a lot of respect for lawyers and what they do, but I couldn't see myself doing that for the rest of my life, personally. So I switched and said, okay, I'm going to go pre-med then. And that's what I did. I switched my major pretty much almost day one of going to school and college. And along that path, we had to take obviously multiple classes that are STEM related, you know, along the biological sciences, physical sciences, as well as chemistry. And I ran across microbiology and absolutely fell in love with it. And I said, definitely, that's where I want to focus. So instead of going to medical school, I decided to go to grad school for microbiology and really focused on the life sciences, really focused on earlier in my career, developing medical devices, actually doing vaccine production, which is a hot item nowadays, and actually doing drug discovery work to help to shorten the treatment window for tuberculosis. So I got to dabble in all of those. When I was working and doing my work for TB in the lab, there was a group that came and said they had computer software where they could actually show us from our active, they could make a million different compounds with the computer and actually kind of predict activity off of that. And that blew me away because I'd never experienced that. And when we didn't choose them to actually write the grant, I was kind of disappointed because I really wanted to dabble in that. And it really caught my interest and it never really left my mind. And for a whole year, I thought about that. And I said, you know what? I probably need to make a decision. Am I going to keep working the same analog way? Or am I really, really going to take a look at what, you know, what can, you know, data and computer science and what can that really look like for my career? Is that where it's going? And sure enough, had a conversation with the co-founder, and he said, absolutely, at that time, we didn't have Billflare. It was, you know, I was working for another company, and he said, in 10 years, every industry will be data-driven. And sure enough, you're seeing about a decade later, we are here, right? Data is the new bacon, the new oil, the new gold, whatever you want to call it. This is the conversations that we're having across all industries. So here we are.
For any listeners who are interested in a career like yours, what do you think is the most important thing that they can learn?
The most important thing, I think when I peeled back the onion, I knew that there were some deficits that I definitely had, especially, you know, although I was in STEM already and we worked with data, I needed to dive a little deeper and kind of sharpen some skill sets so far as getting, you know, certifications. Because when you're talking about data and processing data, you really need a lot of compute power. So you're probably looking at cloud computing, definitely. So looking at how can you get some of those, you know, certifications like on AWS or some of the other cloud providers to help you along. There's a ton of content out there to help you do that. Number two, I would say definitely look at the process in which these platforms and software are developed. You really want to look at going agile as much as possible. A lot of times that's how software is developed. And I think it's not something that's really taught in school. So it's definitely something you're going to have to go outside of that box to really dive into that. You can also get certifications in that as well, should you want to go more on that side. But you're going to have to know how to work in agile teams to really iterate and innovate and keep up with, you know, the way technology basically seems like every day there's something new that comes out. You want to be able to keep up with that and stay ahead of the curve. So I would say process is super important. But the number one thing would be people. You have to really learn how to work with all different types of people to be able to drive a solution to success over the finish line. So I would say definitely learn some of those skill sets as well. Again, not something you always learn in school. This may be something you have to take offline, but I would definitely say look at people, process, and then platform for sure.
Great, so you mentioned AWS. Could you tell us a little bit about what AWS is and what it could be used for?
Yes, so Amazon Web Services is a cloud provider. They actually, if you think about it, it's the same as our electric power grid, right? They actually have the power grid, and we can then, you know, just like your local maybe FPL, like for us, we're in Florida, Florida Power and Light. We are then able to utilize electricity at the switch of, you know, just flipping a switch in our home, and we have electricity, or we can switch it off, and we only pay for what we use. And you don't have to have a power plant in your backyard. You don't have to maintain and, you know, cool, you know, and do all of that, right? You just consume. And that's the same way they've done with compute power. Basically, they've taken compute power, and they are the power plant, if you will, of the compute power that you can then say, hey, if I need to spin up, you know, X amount of compute to actually process this amount of data, you're able to do that literally at the click of a button. And when you don't need it anymore, you literally can shut it down instead of owning the whole server farm and doing the cooling, heating, the security, and keeping it, you know, and owning it 100% of the time, whether you're using it or not. It's similar to at your house, you wouldn't keep all your lights on, right? Even whether you're home or not, to actually utilize it in every single room. So it kind of has that same concept, if you will, for computing.
It's really interesting. So since you are a woman in your, how do you feel being a woman has impacted your career?
I would have to say it's been on both sides. I would have to say more positive though than negative. I would have to say, especially during these times, you see a lot of outreach for women, reskilling, a lot of diversity, you know, initiatives and talks, and more so than that, actually people putting, you know, some wheels into motion. So I would say now more than ever, you probably can find a good support for women in tech or women in STEM in general, period, than probably earlier in the career, right? I will say there are still challenges. I remember being in a meeting with a client, and my co-founder was also there, who's a male, and basically he told me that I probably, you know, we were trying to plan our next steps, and I think it was going to be a meeting that was going to be later in the day and probably going to the evening. And he said, shouldn't you be at home taking care of your kids? So I just thought it was interesting. I said, I wonder how many other, you know, male customers or counterparts actually feel that if a woman, you know, in STEM or just a woman in general is working beyond a certain time, that she's not by some means taking care of her kids. And how come that was not posed to any of the males in the room, which all of them had kids as well. So I thought that that was really interesting. One of the guys called him out actually from his team and said, wow, like you really can't say that. But I thought that was really interesting. I mean, I didn't say anything because I said, hey, you know, I just took it in because I said, you know, I think that's interesting. And then you just have to see it from other people's point of view. I really like to do that a lot of the time, whether it, you know, I agree with it or not. What prompts that person to feel that that is the right thing to say, and how can we change the narrative on that? I'm always trying to think about it from that lens. So I think there's still some challenges, as you can you could imagine. And how many people feel that way and just don't say anything? That could be very interesting as well too. So
do you feel like as a woman, there's more pressure for you to balance your work life and your home life?
I think I felt that earlier on in my career. I think my children are older now, so you know they're a lot more self-sufficient. At the same time, I've also learned work-life balance. So even when I didn't have my own company and I was working for others, I struggled with that work-life balance. I think, you know, women do feel that extra pressure because there is a lot of that. It's kind of unsaid and sometimes said, as you know, we mentioned in meetings, where they kind of call you out and you're like, wow, you really do start to, you know, question yourself, you know, and ask your kids, I mean, have I been there for you enough? So I think there are some challenges, and I think you have to look at different types of challenges, single mothers, like there's a lot of different pressures that can be out there. But I think there are ways that even within our company that we've tried to address that.
Thank you, Tia.
Right. And that was part one in an ongoing series from Gabby Hall and her podcast series, Notorious SHE, speaking with CEO and co-founder of Bell Floor Technologies, Tia Dubisong. The Notorious SHE series is a podcast and resource guide by women in STEM work for future women in STEM work. For more info on the series, check out notoriousshe.com and look for more on Tia's company. See www.bellfloortech.com.
And for this final segment, we are joined on air by Hugh Johnson, retired meteorologist. Frequent listeners will be familiar with his reports on As the World Turns, but given climate change, perhaps a better title is As the World Burns. So, Hugh, hello, are you here?
I am here.
Welcome, and thanks for joining us. Before we dive further into why global warming is so bad, I know last week you talked about the cool bias thermometer sensor at the Albany International Airport. Can you remind us about that? And is there any more you want to say about it?
Absolutely, yes. It's the thermometer, the sensor is supposedly not the problem, but the problem is that the temperature readings are coming out 2 to 2.5, perhaps 3 degrees consistently too cool compared to a standard, a golden standard, if you will, which isn't hard to do. I do want to make one quick clarification because one of my listeners last week brought this to my attention. I was comparing my weather station to the Albany Airport, and no, I never calibrated it. And it, but see, it's mine is not an official co-op or an official observation station. I was just comparing mine to the airport because it was very close before they put that new thermometer in, and then it suddenly became warmer at my place. But mine's not a golden standard. So I wanted to clarify that, that I'm not suggesting that mine is spot on. It was not perfectly, you know, perfectly accurate. But anyways, yeah, there is a problem with the airport thermometer, and it's supposedly going to be changed by the winter. But, you know, they know there's a problem, but they don't know. They claim it's not the sensor.
And you think that just to also for more clarification, you certainly believe that man-made climate change is real.
Oh yeah, yeah. Because here's the problem: we're emitting CO2 into the atmosphere. We've almost doubled the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere in the last couple of hundred years. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it is because CO2 traps heat, and when you trap heat, you warm the planet. The air, the heat cannot escape, and it's slowly increasing the temperature of the Earth by doing that.
And what's an example of climate change? The effect of climate change here locally?
Good question. Yeah. Here's an example. Okay. So every 30 years, the National Climate Center releases new climate averages for areas like Albany, Boston, Baltimore, whatever, different cities. Here in Albany, in the last 30 years, our fall average has gone up 3 degrees since 1970. Now, it may not seem like a lot, but that's pretty significant. It's our second warmest season of warming next to winter. So our falls are generally a lot warmer than they used to be. And that average went up a degree in the last 10 years. So that's a little bit of an alarm signal, in my humble opinion, faster than it's gone up any time before, at least since we've been keeping modern records.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot. And you've mentioned before that you've contacted Representative Tonko and both senators about the problem. Have you heard back from them or heard any kind of climate change response?
No, I haven't. I haven't heard a darn thing. Now, someone told me, I forget who it was, that you have to be patient. It might take another week or so. You know, so I'll certainly won't keep bugging them yet, but I will definitely be contacting them if I don't hear in the next couple of days or week.
So I've heard some people refer to this as the Anthropocene period in geological history, where the major effect is the human change in geology and in the climate. Can you say a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, again, you know, it's all about the CO2. I mean, basically what happened is the Industrial Revolution began a long time ago. Well, not that long in terms of mankind, but in the late 1700s. And we started, that's when we had the coal burning, fossil fuels really became rampant and increased rapidly through the 1800s and into the 1900s as well. And initially, with a lot of the aerosols being ejected, there was some times where there was actually a little cooling going on, and that continued off and on. Now, there were some warming times too, but cooling through around 1970. After 1970, the air got cleaner. We had the aerosols got cleaner. We've had some improvement on air quality, but the problem is we're still emitting a lot of CO2, not just this country, but of course, China, India, Russia, all the major powers are continuing to produce a lot of CO2. Cars, a lot of it in cars and other fossil fuel burning things. So, and natural gas, unfortunately, even though it's a little cleaner, certainly than oil and coal, it still emits CO2 and even a little bit of what's called methane into the atmosphere, which is even a more efficient gas to trap heat. But CO2 is the major problem.
With something that feels like it's such a severe threat to everybody on this planet, what's been the biggest holdup of trying to address it? What's everybody dragging their feet for, in your opinion?
Well, unfortunately, I don't like to get into politics involved, but politics has gotten involved, and there was a side that supports it and a side that doesn't. The side that doesn't is increasingly resistant, and first they said, oh, no, there's no warming at all. Now they admit there's warming, but say, of course, it's natural. And then some say it's going to start cooling again, and there's all kinds of crazy things out there. And, you know, because it hasn't, their house hasn't flooded yet, they don't see the big picture. And the problem, it seems like, unfortunately, by the time we get strong consensus that there is a problem with the climate, it might be too late. I hope not, but that's unfortunately how it could end up going if this continues along its merry way.
That actually is something I wanted to check with you about, because I've read conflicting reports. One is that we are now in a self-feeding loop where the melting of the ice cap and the ice sheets is creating warmer oceans, which is increasing the melting of ice caps and ice sheets. And some people say it is too late. Other people say, no, 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 we can reverse it. What are your thoughts besides just hopes and prayers?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I agree. I think we can possibly reverse it, but I think we got to act pretty quickly and, you know, very accordingly. I mean, we're trying to get like electric cars. That's going to help a little bit. There are even some ways that scientists can actually suck the CO2 out of the atmosphere, because that's another problem. The CO2 that's in the atmosphere is not going to go away that quickly. That's going to linger for a long time. And that's a huge gargantuan problem. And something that still, the technology is very small, very, you know, infinite at trying to get that done. But, you know, and again, I think the problem is, you know, it is political. I mean, we have our current administration that really is on to the global warming concern, but it has its hands tied. And you know, I mean, again, this is the fact. I mean, I'm not trying to, this is what we're seeing. And some things are getting done, but a lot of things aren't. And I'd personally like to see a much better rail system. I know rail system is not, everything leaves a carbon footprint, and so does even electric trains, but it's a lot less than jets. It's a lot less than cars. So it would be an improvement. And we're just, in my opinion, we're not moving quickly enough in that direction, and I know why. I know exactly why.
Are there any short-term benefits to climate change? Will I be able to grow oranges in my backyard? It's coming soon here in New York.
That's a good question. I do agree that, you know, we have to look at, there are some short-term benefits. We have a longer growing season. Albany, I think their growing season is almost a month longer than it used to be, or at least several weeks. Probably not going to quite be ready to grow oranges anytime soon. If we do, we're probably in trouble. But we are definitely seeing plants move further north, and we're seeing things extend further into the season. So that is, in a way, that is a positive thing. But on the flip side of the coin, rising, we talked about the seawater rising. That's very, very concerning, because something like, I think a quarter, over 10% of the population, maybe 20%, live near, like within a couple of miles of the coast. It's a large number. So if you raise that sea level just 10 feet, that's a disaster. So any benefit, like longer seasons further north you go and things like that, are probably offset by, you know, coastal areas being inundated and greater disease and greater weather extremes and things like that. So unfortunately, it's not a total, there are a few benefits, but I think they're strongly negated by other concerning ones.
Okay, and unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much, Hugh. This has been a live conversation with Hugh Johnson, retired meteorologist. For past reports, visit mediasanctuary.org and listen for Hugh each week on Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you. Have a great night, both of you.
And that concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Bria Barthel.
And I'm Jody Cowan. Our engineer for this and most episodes is Sina Bazila Hickey.
This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07. Contact us for the link. And thank you to all our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. If you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer. See mediasanctuary.org for more details and a donate link.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. You can find all the stories from today's program on our website through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thank you for tuning in.